Good morning. Welcome to the March 1st meeting of the House Economic Development and Trade Committee. Today we're going to talk about broadband and telecommunications issues. As we all know, access to strong internet connections, good telecommunication service is crucial underpinning for economic opportunity around our state. And so evolution of our telecommunications and broadband sector is really an important issue for people on this committee. We're going to begin with some contextual overview and an informational hearing on broadband and economic growth. We're going to invite forward, please, Christopher Cameron of Business Oregon and Brian Conway with Telecommunications and Water Division of PUC to talk about the state of broadband in Oregon, and then we're going to move into some public hearings and possible work sessions. Thanks. Yes, and before we jump into that, thank you for the prompt by Mr. Crawford. We have a new member. We are delighted to welcome Representative Lewis, who is the new member for the Christmas Tree District, and I would love to invite you to introduce yourself for the committee, the community here.
Okay. Yes, my name is Rick Lewis. I represent District 18. My background is primarily in law enforcement. I spent 40 years in law enforcement, last 28 years as a police chief in three different Oregon cities, including Silverton, military veteran, and I was elected mayor in Silverton in 2014 and was just starting my second term when I was selected to the House of Representatives, so I resigned my position as mayor in Silverton. So.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to have you with us. I've heard great things about you, and we wish our friend and colleague, Rep. Olson, well on his new posting.
Thank you.
But glad to see you here. So welcome, gentlemen. Please go in either order, and again by stating your name for the record.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Leininger, Vice Chair Marsh, and Vice Chair Smith, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Tamron. I'm with the Oregon Business Development Department. Thank you for allowing me to speak today and provide you with a briefing on the very topical subject of broadband telecommunications. I'd like to note for the committee that two reports were submitted to the Legislative Assembly at the end of last year that should provide useful information, resources, regarding broadband. The first is Broadband in Oregon. This is a report of the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council to the Legislative Assembly on the affordability and accessibility of broadband technology in the state and on broadband technology use in healthcare, energy management, education, and government. The second is a strategies for broadband infrastructure deployment, adoption, and utilization in rural cities and counties. This is a report of the Business Development Department on strategies for broadband infrastructure deployment, adoption, and utilization, and I believe Adam has made those reports available to you. Broadband infrastructure will always be a work in progress. Yes. As technologies and applications change over time, and what constitutes broadband in terms of transmission speed has proven to be a moving target. In general usage, broadband is a label that's applied to any communications technology offering a better data transmission rate than that available over a standard voice-free telephone line. Up until 2008, the FCC defined broadband as a transport service for data supporting a transmission rate of at least 200 kilobits, that's kilobits, in one direction. Since then, the standard for broadband has been increasing. The FCC's National Broadband Plan in 2010 increased it to 4 megabits per second down, 1 megabit per second up. The FCC's most recent benchmark is now 25 megabits per second down, 3 megabits per second up. Broadband network access is important because the Internet has emerged as the global platform for communication, for business, for government, education, information storage and distribution, and entertainment. And that's making competitive high-speed access to the Internet communications networks essential for Oregon's institutions, businesses, and individual citizens to be competitive in an information age global economy. The internet has grown from use by less than 1% of the world's population in 1995, the year that it went public, to use by over 40% of the world's population. That's 3.4 billion users in 2016. With another billion users expected to be added over the next 5 years. Globally, there's $1.9 trillion in e-commerce conducted over the internet in 2016, and that's expected to grow to over $4 trillion by 2020. Broadband may be viewed as a meta-infrastructure, that is, an infrastructure that adds capabilities and value and enhances other infrastructure. When we look at power grids, transportation systems, water and wastewater systems, the emerging Internet of Things, all are enhanced by the communications, command and control, and service functions that are enabled by broadband. Broadband is becoming an essential service. This is a statement from the National Broadband Plan written by the FCC. It states, like electricity a century ago, broadband is a foundation for economic growth, job creation, global competitiveness, and a better way of life. It's enabling entire industries and unlocking vast new possibilities for existing ones. It's changing how we educate children, deliver health care, manage energy, ensure public safety, engage government, and access, organize, and disseminate knowledge. Broadband is essential for businesses of any size that want to be traded sector businesses, that want to be competitive and effectively interact with suppliers and customers. It's essential for governments that want to be responsive to the needs of citizens, support civic engagement, and provide information and services in the way that their constituents want to receive them. It's essential for schools that want to utilize digital course content, distance learning resources, to teach students, communicate with and engage parents, and professionally develop staff. It's essential for libraries that want to provide local community access to the information resources of the world and provide broadband access to members of the local community that do not have it in their homes. It's essential for power utilities that wish to deploy smart grid features and enable energy management functions and services. It's essential for healthcare providers that want to provide a full range of clinical services to patients where they live. And this is particularly true in rural areas. And it's essential for first responders that want to access video, text, and image data in real time for public safety. When we talk about broadband, essentially we are talking about the distribution or last mile networks that provide telecommunications network access to end users in their homes, schools, places of work, and in this age of mobility anywhere that they happen to be. They connect us to high capacity backbone networks that extend across a city, a region, or a wide area, connecting to the World Wide Web and the national and global networks that give us our any place to any place communications capability. It enables us to pick up our smartphone, our tablet, and connect instantly to Portland, London, or Beijing. Broadband distribution technologies include digital subscriber line services over legacy twisted pair telephone lines, cable modem services delivered over coaxial cable, mobile wireless, primarily through 3G and fourth generation 4G technologies today, with 5G expected by about 2020, fixed location wireless services networks, satellite, and fiber to the premises or fiber to the home. Service providers include franchise telephone companies, franchised cable companies, mobile wireless cellular companies, satellite companies, competitive access providers, both landline and wireless, and municipalities, public entities, public-private partnerships, and co-ops. Ahead of many states, Oregon has a formalized broadband public policy in statute and resolution. It is the goal of the state to promote access to broadband services for all Oregonians, to improve the economy, improve the quality of life, and reduce the economic gap between Oregon communities that have access to broadband digital applications and those do not. It's the policy of the state to promote, facilitate, and encourage activities and projects and businesses that improve Oregon's IP network infrastructure and performance and connectivity to the internet backbone for the benefit of Oregon's users. Regarding public safety, it's the policy of the state of Oregon to encourage and support the deployment of broadband access in areas of the state where it does not exist and ensure that a secure conduit is available for emergency communications and public safety networks in all Oregon communities. It's the policy of the state to promote and facilitate activities by Oregon's healthcare and education communities and service providers to develop standards for interoperability and communications. Oregon has a forum for the discussion of an exploration of broadband issues and public policy. The governor appointed Broadband Advisory Council, which includes seats representing the Oregon House and Senate. This council, with a mission to encourage broadband coordination and collaboration in the state, encourage the development of broadband applications, and importantly, promote the use of broadband by citizens and communities so that its benefits can be realized. This is from the Interactive Oregon Broadband Map, which is available at www.broadband.oregon.gov, and shows the density of broadband service providers. The darker blue, the more providers are available. Both in broadband availability and utilization compared to other states, Oregon ranks highly, especially for being a big western state with a relatively small population. Last month, the Rural Telecommunications Congress released an updated 50 States of Broadband report, a survey of broadband activity investment nationwide. In the new report, Oregon was ranked number 4 in the nation for broadband availability, number 4 in the nation for broadband adoption, and number 21 in the nation for state-level support for broadband deployment and adoption. This shows service availability by transmission speed, with a darker green showing the higher transmission rates. So again, broadband is a moving target. It's a very dynamic industry and marketplace. We're seeing rapid advances in technology. We're seeing distinct market migration from voice to video, text, and data. We're seeing market migration from landline phone service to wireless services and to broadband service. We're seeing network migration to Internet Protocol, or IP, the de facto worldwide standard for data communications. We're seeing growth of end-user device mobility, which means increasingly we are wireless to the end-user device. We're seeing the emergence of cloud computing and everything as a service located in the network instead of being on the end user device or at the user's physical location. And we're seeing the emergence of the Internet of Things. According to a Cisco Visual Networks Index, with the Internet of Things, we expect to see more than 10 billion new devices connected to the Internet over the 5 years. It's the next big wave of development. And we're seeing the emergence of broadband as being the end user's primary connection for all applications, for work, for personal business, and for lifestyle activities. I think that one of the greatest challenges in public policy facing Oregon and the nation is the continuing digital divide. Oregon has made significant progress in the deployment of broadband infrastructure throughout the state over the past 15 years, but it's not enough. Again, it's a work in progress, and the digital divide continues to exist. 10 years ago, the digital divide was considered to be between those geographic areas that had digital subscriber line services and those areas that had dial-up internet access. Today, the divide is between those geographic areas that have access to or greater than the latest FCC broadband standard. Again, currently 25 megabits per second down, 3 megabits per second up, and those areas that do not. Nationally, 55% of people living in rural areas have access to service transmission speeds considered by the FCC as broadband. That compares to 94% of people living in urban areas that have that access. And I will add that only 37% of Americans living on tribal lands have that access. And the divide is not just related to population density, but also to the factors of income, age, ethnicity, and education. Less than 50% of the households with income in the bottom 20% use the internet at home, compared to 95% of the households with income in the top 20%. So the digital divide continues to exist and may well be contributing to the economic divide that also exists between urban and rural areas of the state. There's an increasing awareness of the value and potential of broadband as, a strategic tool for economic and community development. And there are many different technology and business model initiatives being used to address the broadband challenge across the state and across the country. But there is not a silver bullet. There's not one solution that works for all communities in all situations. Perhaps one factor that comes close to being a silver bullet is fostering local champions, elected officials, government officials, educators, business people, service providers, and other community leaders that become engaged. Many rural communities across Oregon and across the nation that have competitive broadband services in place today often owe that status to a local champion that saw the need and took action to make it happen. Thank you for your attention. I believe Brian Conway here from the PUC is going to make a presentation, and then we will both do our best to answer any questions.
Okay. Good morning. For the record, my name is Brian Conway. I'm the administrator of the Telecommunications and Water Division at the Oregon Public Utility Commission. What I'm going to talk about is a little bit different than what Chris did. What I want to talk about is basically three things. I want to talk a little bit about measuring broadband in the idea of where do we stand. I've heard some of the other hearings around here, and there's been lots of rankings and things, and I wanted to touch on that some. Briefly, what other states have been doing that seems to have been successful, very briefly on that, and then to make it have more relevance perhaps to the two House bills you're going to hear, talk about the PUC's role with respect to broadband and what we've done over the last, last 10 or 12 years. So with that, the first one here, what I wanted to show you was the, you know, and this mirrors what Chris said, is that overall Oregon is, on average, doing well compared to other states. And so as you look at the map here, it's, you know, the lighter orange means that we've got fairly fast download speeds. We're not, on average, as good as California or Washington. Something you'll probably hear lots of different statistics about broadband, and so one thing I'd point out, this is an average. If you use a median, Oregon looks a lot better. And so to me, what that tells me, and this is the interpretation of these things, is that when you use medians, it means, well, we have some really fast speeds for a large population, say the Portland area, maybe the Willamette Valley. And so when you look at the median, we do better. So if people are ranking states, if they use medians, Oregon looks better. If they use averages, we don't look as good. And another part is that the data sources are somewhat scattered. If you use some of the official government data sources, they stopped updating in 2014. I know Chris and his group have been continuing to do updates for Oregon using the FCC data. But one thing I thought, even after pointing out that on average we do well, I went and used some of the national broadband map data and looked at how do our different counties rank as far as how do they, you know, with a download speed of greater than 100 megabits per second. That's pretty fast. And so not surprisingly, Multnomah County is number one. 99.2% of the households in Multnomah County have access to 100 megabits or faster. Curry and Jackson and Deschutes are also up there in the top one. Benton is as well. But the part I found more interesting is if you get down to Grant, Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler, 0% of them have access to that speed, according to the national data provided by the NTIA. So there's quite a disparity across the state. In some places they have, you know, very, very fast access, and other places they don't. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, there's a lot of different ways of slicing this up. And so one person may get up and say Oregon's ranked number 4. The next one gets up and says Oregon's ranked number 15. And the answer is, yeah, they're both right. It depends on how you're measuring it. And so that's the key, I think. If you're using a consistent source, you can kind of tell where we are. The second piece on the next figure here for us is what other states are doing, and I apologize, that is not super clear here, but what I wanted to point out is that in all circumstances, when you look at what other states are doing, they do better if they have a state broadband office. And so the state broadband offices can mean a lot of different things. Typically they have staff. They're working at the state to promote broadband throughout their state, and sometimes they're quite large. New York has a budget of about $500 million for their state broadband office. We have a broadband advisory council, which is not a broadband office, but I think they've done some good things, and as Chris has pointed out, you know, the Oregon has been doing well, and I think some of the planning and survey work they've done has helped clarify that. To the point, now this is, I don't have a slide for this. If you guys want the this information, I can certainly provide it. What I thought I'd do is talk a bit about the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And let me start off by saying, as of right now, we have no statutory authority over broadband. We can't regulate rates, terms, service, and we really, you know, it is not something that's under our general powers in all of those lines. But throughout the years, we've played a pretty valuable role, and we've been more of a supporting role to both the legislature, the governor's office, and through some of the FCC and national partners. And so the earliest I found, but I believe there may have been stuff earlier than this, was back in 2005, the Oregon legislature enacted Senate Bill 13 and tasked the Oregon Commission to report each session on availability, demand, and use of broadband services. So this is, you know, 12 years ago we started doing this. That is since sunsetted. In 2009, the governor at the time, Governor Kulongowski, designated the Oregon Commission as the sole entity to receive the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act monies for mapping of the broadband in the state. And mapping and planning. In the planning grant, we worked very closely with the Broadband Advisory Council. 2010, my staff reviewed and advised the governor on 6 projects that were submitted as a governor recommendation to another branch of the federal government, I did write it out. So Broadband Technology and Opportunity Program. I've just referred to it as BTOP for so long, I can't remember the acronym sometimes. But that was about $55 million worth of projects that did get funded from the federal government and help out in Oregon. Now, there's a couple of places. The next two, 2010 and 2011, are where the commission itself actually, you know, without not being a support, wasn't a report or a grant or something, but the two things were two different mergers. Frontier Communications brought some of Verizon Wireless or Verizon's service territory, and in that we'll call it a merger, but in that acquisition or merger, the commission adopted a stipulation that had Frontier spending, let's say, an additional $15 million to expand broadband. The point to that was to help ensure they met a public interest test showing that the public was benefited by the transaction. So while I said earlier we don't have direct statutory authority, we were able to, with negotiations between the parties and the company, have the company agree as part of approval of their transaction that they would provide that benefit. And then similarly in 2011, CenturyLink and Qwest Communications merged, and in that case they had a commitment to spend $45 million improving broadband in the state of Oregon. So it was the same thing. We couldn't have ordered them to do it, but we could, you know, accept an overall stipulation that said they would spend that money. A couple more things. 2012, the commission provided a report to the Broadband Advisory Council on the status of broadband deployment by electric and gas utilities in Oregon. 2005 through 2013, we provided a report to the legislature annually on the availability of advanced telecommunications capability in public bodies. That has since sunsetted, and it was an interesting project, and I can tell you that it it had some things that were more interesting than others. The most memorable, of course, was we called up a local sheriff's office as a public body to ask about their infrastructure. We happened to call the day after a terrorist threat had been made by a dam in their area, and so it was quite unnerving to them to have people calling and asking about their infrastructure at the time. But we did get more information from them eventually once they found out that we were actually there to help and not to find out other things. We do have a member, Commissioner Bloom from our agency is a member of the Broadband Advisory Council, so that there is some coordination going on with that. Finally, the state of Oregon received about $6 million for basically four projects, and some of those we worked through with the Broadband Advisory Council. And so this was state capacity building, and this was, we worked with Chris, and I know he could provide a lot more information on this, but it was creating long-term goals and basically plans on how communities could attract broadband and so forth. Technical assistance provided training for Oregon's rural small businesses, application usage and development. Did that with in partnership with Lynn Benton Community College. And then with Association of Oregon Counties, we provided some money through our grant to assist them in providing, you know, the counties to be able to become more paperless and provide video conferencing and things along those lines. And then finally was the one that is started the map that Chris was able to show you, data collection, integration, and validation. And so we did a lot of work on that. The most recent thing was in 2015, and I see Representative Marsh here from the House Revenue Committee as well. They are talking about this, is that the PUC was tasked with reviewing potential projects for a tax break that is a subject in their committee now. That was Senate Bill 611 from 2015, and so my engineers were going out and verifying whether they could make the project work or not work. So in a nutshell, I think we've been very, very involved in broadband. I think we've been a good asset to both the legislature, to the governor's office, and working with our partners at Broadband Advisory Council to provide expertise in planning. And when available, the commission has taken advantage of opportunities to try to push broadband out into areas where it is underserved and unserved.
Thank you. That's helpful. Committee members, this is an opportunity for us to ask questions about essentially the role of government, the role of the state in supporting broadband access in Oregon, both as to this bill that we're hearing today, but in general, and, you know, also perhaps if we have questions about the evolution of wireless connection technologies and how that informs the relevance of broadband networks and other telecommunications networks, this is a good opportunity. So anybody have questions for our panel? Rep Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Rep Marsh.
We're starting to hear a lot more enthusiasm over 5G. And I wondered if we could have your thoughts about whether 5G represents a technology that might allow us to leapfrog some of the things that we're doing now as we extend our broadband services, particularly to rural areas. What do you think the potential is there? What do you think that the impediments might be or barriers? Do you think we're on that path or not?
Thank you, Chair Leininger, Representative Helm. 5G wireless technology is, you know, again, a great example of the dynamic changes that take place in technology to enable and provide broadband services. what 5G technology will do will dramatically increase, again, the data capacity, data carrying capability of wireless networks. It has potential for application in rural areas. I've seen many industry reports and articles talking about the potential for 5G as a not only a mobile wireless technology, but as a fixed wireless technology. This is where the end user, you know, is not mobile. Transceiver maybe is at a fixed location attached to a building, or it cannot not move. That remains to be seen as to how viable it will be. It's undergoing testing today. It will also help enable the growth of this Internet of Things. These are, again, literally going to be billions of devices worldwide that communicate with other devices and not engaging humans directly. So sensors and monitoring systems that will, you know, enable self-driving cars, that, you know, to agriculture, to having soil sensors that tell systems, irrigation systems, how dry the soil is and whether it needs irrigation or not, or whether monitoring smart homes, health monitoring in the homes, just, again, a very wide range of applications that increasingly require network connectivity so that data that's collected can be sent somewhere to be analyzed and acted on. So I think 5G has tremendous potential on a wide array of applications, and rural broadband is one of them.
I actually love to jump in right before that, Marsh. I don't know if this panel right here is the right panel to answer the question, but one of the things that I'm hoping, and maybe other people in the room who are intending to testify may be in a position to speak to this, I would really love to understand kind of what the physical infrastructure relationship is between telecommunications, network cable, broadband network, and wireless, and then 5G. Like, I don't really understand if we're talking about the same backbone, the same architecture, or if one modality is a totally different infrastructure, and if wireless does not require broadband fiber, is there a question of relevance about the kind of physical infrastructure we're laying now, or is there not? And so I'd love to have someone who actually has knowledge of that kind of operationally be able to speak to that, if there's someone in the room who can. I need sort of a 101, and I don't know, I don't feel like I've gotten a 101 level intro on that yet, but if it's possible, I would love to hear that. I don't know if anyone else feels they could use that also.
So, Rep. Leininger, I can provide a high-level overview. There are people who are going to be more knowledgeable than me, and I also have another answer for Representative Helm. He asked about impediments to 5G. But I think I can wrap them both into the same answer, which is, wireless networks still require the fiber backhaul in that. So when you make a wireless phone call, it isn't over the wire to a tower and then radioed to another tower into that one. It still drops down onto a network, which in many times is provided by the incumbent local exchange carriers in the state. So it hits the tower, goes down, and it's carried over wires. To the same thing would happen with the 5G networks. They do provide data, but they're still, it hits a tower, goes down, and it's probably on fiber after that and moving through. To the impediments that Representative Helm talked about, from my office, I know that one of the things that a division in my agency has is the Safety and Reliability Division. They deal with pole attachments. And so one of the things for 5G is that they're smaller antennas, they cover a smaller space, so you need a lot more of them. And then where to place them is probably one of the impediments that people will deal with, is because they're, you know, can you make them look like a tree in a neighborhood? Do you put them on power poles? And ideally, for an antenna, you'd want it up high. Well, up high on the power poles is where the power flows. That's a safety issue, and so that's one of the things they're dealing with. And I also know that Department of Transportation would be involved in that. Their siting of these poles in the public right-of-way is an issue as well. So there's some of that. To your question more directly, Chair Leininger, you know, all of these networks seem to interrelate. If you're going to use your VoIP phone on a wireless network in your home, it's still going to end up hitting fiber. If you're calling somebody who's not on that same network, it's going to come down, it's going to go through the ILEC just like a regular phone call and end up somewhere else. And I think that's one of the things you'll hear from Mr. Wolf when he's talking about House Bill 2091, is about how do we create networks that are capable of doing all the different things here and is really complementary to all the technologies out there.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
I can add, again, we'll talk about 5G, short for fifth generation. We've had several generations of wireless technology in our cellular networks. They began as analog systems and then migrated to digital technology that can handle greater numbers of users. And then as we move through the different generations, we've added data transmission capability and then expanded levels of data transmission capability. And if we look at the telecommunications infrastructure here, the primary application of 3G, 4G, and 5G are as distribution networks, so they're wireless networks that connect end users to, again, a cell tower that connects to the rest of the telecommunications infrastructure. So we have these distribution last-mile networks, like the local mobile wireless carrier, like the local telephone exchange, the local cable company, head-end coaxial cable network, and so forth. Then that local distribution network connects through backbone networks to, again, to the rest of the world, to national and global networks, to the world, to the World Wide Web. So there's where the role
Thank
or
you.
The piece of that fits.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to go to Rep. Marsh and then Rep. Reschke, please, and then Rep. Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you for your presentations. I think this is a tremendously vital service to our communities and sort of fundamental to the whole idea of economic development in both urban and rural parts of the state. And I hope it's an area that this committee gets to do a lot of work in the future. I had several questions, and you may call me off and let others speak. But first, I wanted to go back to the map that you showed that showed a density of providers. And sort of implicit in that map is the concept that it's good to have a lot of providers. Is that the message from that?
Well, the map displays, again, as you say, the density of service providers, Representative Marsh. I think the experience has been when you do have multiple competitive providers, the quality of service tends to improve and the cost of service tends to be reduced. So if there is a single provider in a market, you know, the pressure for upgrading the service or reducing costs is less than if there is a market served with multiple competitors and consumers have options.
Okay, so that would suggest that public policy might want to move in a direction that encourages competition in this realm.
I would say yes.
Yeah. You sure may, please.
Okay. I wanted to just to get your all's input a little bit more on that question of regulatory authority. I have been concerned as a former official in a city about the lack of any sort of regulatory authority we have in terms of wireless providers, and especially as we move to 5G, where we're contemplating putting permanent fixtures on telephone poles or streetlights throughout a community. We don't have franchises for these kinds of things. Do you have any comment on how you see that authority evolving and taking place as we move to these different kinds of technologies that our communities are absolutely dependent upon?
So, Chair Leininger, Rep. Marsh, what I can speak to is what the PUC has. In its statutes, we have no statutory authority over cell phone and that. The closest we would have would be over the safety and the pricing of pole attachments, and so they would attach to the existing power poles and other telecommunications poles. As far as broadband as an information service, there's a lot of things going on at the FCC, but for the most part, they've been fairly clear that we're preempted from federal law from having any statutory authority over pricing terms and conditions for broadband. So as far as how that may change going down the road, that's going to be something you need to look for a change from the FCC from. It's not something I think the state can do from the bottom up.
Do you have one more follow-up? Or you
yeah, yeah, one more follow-up.
Okay, and then we'll go to Rep. Rashid, please.
I think you showed him some data that really showed and what we already know, which is that broadband capability is most limited in our rural communities toward the east. If this legislature were to do one thing to support development in our rural communities, do you have a recommendation as to what that would be?
Chair Henninger, Representative Marsh, that's a difficult question. Mm-hmm. As far as one thing, I think it, you know, Oregon has been involved on a public policy level in looking at and working on state-of-the-art telecommunications technology for the state for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. And that, along with having a community of progressive service providers in the state that have made significant investments, I think has helped put us in a position where we rank fairly highly, although that doesn't mean that we don't have gaps and we don't have service issues to address. So I think to the extent that we get engaged at a state level in promoting the importance and value of broadband deployment, adoption, utilization throughout the state has a lot of value. And then to the extent that we can facilitate that through perhaps assisting local communities in planning efforts. Again, I mentioned the value and proven positive impacts of local champions. Mm-hmm. That make things happen faster in one area than they do in another. Things that the state can do to promote that are is also would have a positive effect. And it's a big challenge because broadband infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure is very expensive. It's very complex. Services are difficult to provide and maintain and improve over time. It's a big ticket item, and that's challenging. And Oregon to date really has not provided a lot of direct support or funding in that area. We have had some limited support through the Special Public Works Fund, which supports can be used for telecommunications infrastructure, but it's only available to public entities like municipalities or counties or ports, not available to the private sector. The model for telecommunications infrastructure in the state of Oregon and across the country is primarily a private sector model.
Thank you. Did you want to add to that, or are you all set?
Sure, I'll be very brief. Chair Leininger, Rep. Marsh. As far as just one thing, I'm not sure I could identify a single one. Clearly, in one place, they're looking at tax implications and what that does. I think the subject that you'll be looking at a little bit later this morning is going to be House Bill 2091, which has the potential to provide funding for some of those areas. And so I just tee that up as that.
Thank you. I think that's really on point. All right, Rep. Reschke, and then Rep. Gomberg, and then perhaps we can move forward with some of the additional speakers who want to speak about the bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tambrin and Mr. Conway, for coming. I'm going to build off of my two colleagues' questions here on 5G and how we make it go implement it better, faster, stronger. So my understanding is 5G is MUI faster, but it is also services, each tower services a smaller area. Is that correct?
Rep. Leininger, Representative Reschke, yes, that is correct.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes, please.
Okay. So what I'm looking for is who regulates, what's the application process for putting up more towers? So what I see is when you roll out something like this, it's usually a tower issue, and since we're dealing with smaller service areas, I'm assuming we're going to need more towers. So to roll this out better, how do we make that application faster, cheaper, easier, so it can be ubiquitous across all of Oregon, because I see that as the way forward as far as helping rural Oregon catch up with the urban areas.
So, Chair Leininger, Rep. Reske, I just have to be up front. I am not the expert on siting of cell towers. I believe there's multiple players within cities. It's going to be cities, outside of cities. I believe it's Department of Transportation. And I don't know whether or not counties have a role or what. There's somebody else much more knowledgeable about siting of cell towers that you could
So have. There's no overall Oregon rule for putting up a tower. It's more locally driven. Is that correct?
Chair Leininger, Rep. Reske, I'm not aware of one. Okay. There is not one under the statutes that my agency works under. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Those are great questions, though. And as we try to learn more about kind of the gaps and the physical infrastructure and steps that are needed, I'll be really curious to learn more.
I live
too.
At the end of the internet. The internet comes to my house and stops, right? And so we live on the edge at 5 megabits down. And so I know the pain of living in a different century, basically the 20th century, as far as internet to my house. So
right.
This is a real important issue.
Good.
For
so me. Hopefully we can delve into it even more as we go forward. Thanks for those questions. Rep. Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and good morning, gentlemen. My question is about service redundancy. Faster speeds are great. Multiple providers are great. But often in rural Oregon, it seems somebody sticks a shovel in the ground in Tualatin and our internet and services go down. And that's not simply a matter of accessing Facebook or YouTube. It means we can't run credit cards. We can't take hotel reservations. We can't ship packages. And our post offices go dark. Talk to me for a moment about redundancies.
Yeah, Chair Leininger, Representative Gomberg. You're absolutely right. As we become more reliant and dependent on broadband telecommunications networks for to run our businesses, run our governments, run our schools, provide health care, and live our lives, we need those networks to be robust and reliable and available when and where we need them. We've made a lot of progress in Oregon in terms of service reliability. Going back about 15 years ago, Senate Bill 622, which was opted into by U.S. West at the time, resulted in the construction of 5 self-healing fiber optic rings in Oregon's backbone network, which was a sea change for the state. Prior to that, it was a very common occurrence for eastern Oregon to be isolated by a landslide or a lightning strike that took out equipment or the Oregon coast or southern Oregon, where parts of the state would be isolated, not able to call out or make connections outside. And again, today, that's not viable for a business of almost any size that needs to communicate with their customers and their suppliers. So as a result of that self-healing fiber optic backbone network rings that were constructed in the state, the South Coast was one area that was not included at that time. But since then, we now have fiber infrastructure in place that provides redundant self-healing backbone network connectivity to the South Coast as well. And as a result of this, again, we have that redundancy in place and the network reliance and robustness has dramatically improved, and it has resulted, along with other factors, in making Oregon a very attractive state to locate data centers and call centers, businesses which are absolutely reliant on service or network availability and uptime. Even if they're down for minutes, it can cost them tremendous amounts of money. So that. And also the fact that we're moving to fast packet networks, IP networks, that don't rely on single paths, communication paths, to complete connections. You know, our voice and our data are broken up into data packets that are sent out over the network with multiple available communication links to get to their end destination. So if there is a failure of a router somewhere or a communications link somewhere, the network self-corrects and those connections can reroute over other paths to get to their destination. So network reliability, performance continue to improve and have improved over past years.
Excellent. Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up? Or you said?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
I actually would love to follow up and ask the PUC gentleman a question. So I know in the public utilities space, the kind of PGE space, and my husband works at PGE, so I hear about this some amount, that because the capital infrastructure costs are so high, there is, to some extent, not total redundancy, because there's a recognition that if everyone had to put in exactly the same infrastructure to serve the same areas, it would be a really costly proposition. Is it the case, and my understanding from when I was a Clackamas County Commissioner, we were trying to do broadband infrastructure development in our rural areas, was happening, is that there is piggybacking off the same fiber, and that you know, so that different providers somehow utilize the same broadband fiber, and that's appropriate, because if everyone had to lay their own fiber and open the streets up or install cables that are totally redundant, that would be cost prohibitive. Can you help me understand if that's, am I understanding that correctly? Am I misunderstanding that? And then we can ask the other folks who are going to come testify later if you have different viewpoints about that.
Thank you, Chair Leininger. I think, you know, some of the other people may have some better information on this, but when I say what you're pointing out is something that was on point for the Telecommunication Act of 1996, which said it just doesn't make sense to have multiple telephone lines going to somebody's house, so that if AT&T picks them up or Verizon picks them up or somebody else does, that they all have their own trench to the house. And so under the 1996 Act, they did require carriers to share their facilities. Essentially, someone can lease a line to your house from CenturyLink and provide service to you. As far as the example for the power company, I think that for PGE, that's an example of why the state grants a monopoly, so that you don't have multiple people running power lines through neighborhoods. They say it's more efficient just to provide a monopoly to PGE. And I do know there is choice. There is some Senate Bill 1149 brought in some competition for PGE, but then again, they did not change the distribution system, so you would be buying your power through PGE and over the existing lines. So there is an argument for that. It's my understanding, and I think there's some more knowledgeable people here, perhaps from CenturyLink and others, and Brant Wolf from OTA, they can talk about, but I don't believe that there's a requirement to share fiber facilities either at the federal level or at the state level.
That's helpful. So I guess I would just pose to the larger group the question of, is there an analogy between how we do it with telecommunications, the power, and with this or not? And it looks like someone's shaking his head, so I need to be educated in a bunch of ways on this issue. But thanks for that initial hit on the question. All right. Unless we have more pressing questions for this panel, let's move forward with the public hearings on the bills. And I'm going to open them simultaneously. Thanks, gentlemen, for your help. And then we'll invite people up. We've got some redundancy of people who'd like to offer comments, so we'll just go ahead and invite people up, and you can speak to both bills. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2091 and 2092 and ask Mr. Crawford to speak about what they describe, and then invite Brant Wolf and Trey Hendricks up to Brant Wolf and perhaps Brian Conway up to talk about the bills initially.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2091 allows the Public Utility Commission to use funding from the Universal Service Fund to encourage broadband and telephone service availability, operative July 1st, 2017. It declares an emergency and an effective on passage. The committee is being asked to consider a -1 amendment. The -1 limits universal service surcharge to 8.5% of the sale of retail telecommunication services, removes the emergency clause, and takes effect on the 91st day after sine die. The -1 has a minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact. House Bill 2092 specifies that telecommunication carriers not receiving Universal Service Fund monies are not required to provide retail telecommunication services on demand, extend retail telecommunication services to areas that do not have access to it, or rebuild telecommunication service infrastructure to improve service quality starting July 1st, 2017, declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
So, Mr. Wolf, let's have you come forward, and I'd invite you to speak about the merits or describe in further detail both of those bills. And we may have questions for you, and then we'll move into our panels, please.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association.
The OTA represents incumbent local exchange carriers, which are telephone companies. We don't represent wireless companies, and we don't represent cable telecommunications companies. Telecommunications is a pretty complicated issue to get at some of these things, but this bill, however, 2091, really isn't all that complicated. I've had the opportunity to meet with each one of you individually, with one exception, to talk about this bill, so I've got my testimony's pretty brief, and just got some bullet points to kind of reiterate what I've already said to you all individually, and hopefully prompt some questions if you have any. The Oregon Universal Service Fund was created in 1999 by the legislature to ensure that telecommunication services, as defined by then, was voice service, is available throughout rural Oregon at just and reasonable rates. And that's how the fund is targeted right now. That's important. We all recognize that. The telephone service is important, but broadband is increasingly important, and that's what we hope to get at with this bill. Current support amounts, the fund size is $30 million, trending down to $21 million at the end of 2021, which we can talk about at greater length if you care to. The surcharge rate is 8.5% on retail service of voice only. It does not assessed on wireless carriers, not assessed on broadband services, any things like that. It's just the voice component of telephone service. The largest contributors to the fund are CenturyLink, Comcast, and Frontier Communications, and it tails off precipitously after that amongst the smaller carriers, both the incumbent carriers and competitive providers that also contribute to the fund. Their customers do. I think it's important to note that this is not a windfall for any of these carriers. These companies have an obligation to provide service in rural Oregon as mandated by the legislature, and that's what this fund is targeted at. That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to make sure this service is available in rural parts of the state. It does not go to any kind of urban part of the state whatsoever, Portland, Salem, the Valley. It's a replacement for support that carriers used to get by sharing their network costs with one another. Those are called access charges. Those terminating access charges, when a call terminates an exchange, are trending towards zero. So that support's going away. And this is kind of a replacement for that. The issue of House Bill 2091, really, the public policy issue that I'm asking you to address here is, how should this fund be used? Is it appropriate to use this fund to support broadband networks versus plain old telephone networks? We think it is. While this is a complicated issue, I believe the public policy question that you guys are facing is pretty simple. Is it appropriate or is it not appropriate? I kept this bill simple for a reason. As you all are learning and hearing with the questions you have, these issues should be worked out at the Public Utility Commission, in my opinion, the agency that oversees this fund and manages it. These issues are important. I just have found over the years that trying to work through some of these technical issues that people have opposing views on, this kind of proceeding doesn't really lend itself to that kind of thing very well. It's important to note that this bill, if it's passed and signed into law, does not increase the size of the fund, does not increase the size of the surcharge. It merely asks you to provide some public policy direction to the commission and some support to the commission to do this if a party approaches them to do this. The association has gone to the commission two times and filed petitions affect pretty much what we're asking you to do here today. We were rejected one time. The Department of Justice indicated they did not have the authority to do what we asked them to do and use this fund for broadband support. I believe their attitude has changed a bit and maybe backed off that. But nevertheless, we would like it to be explicit. You have the Dash 1 amendments. Those are meant to address some concerns I heard from elected officials related to the emergency clause. We have taken that out. In conversations with AT&T, they indicated they would like to see a few things happen, one of which was a cap on the surcharge itself in the statute, which we agreed to do. There was another issue. It's kind of technical in nature, but if you care to hear about it, on page 2 of the bill, line 15, it relates to a benchmark issue that was kind of confusing to us as well as AT&T and perhaps staff. I don't speak for them, but everybody agreed that we could really eliminate that line, and the PUC would still have the authority to do some benchmarking work if they thought they needed to do that. So we eliminated that as well, and those are the Dash 1 amendments, which we urge you to adopt if you pass this bill out. I guess beyond that, I will wait for questions. I think that's kind of sums up my testimony. It's pretty brief, so I'm hoping you have some questions for me. But it's a good bill, and we ask you to give it positive consideration. Pass it out to your colleagues with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. That's great. Questions? Yes, Rep. Post.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think pretty much, Brant, you've said, I wanted to thank you. Thank you for, I see the amendment was proposed by you, and I appreciate that people were working together on this, because the two things that stuck out to my mind, obviously the emergency clause, but more importantly, a cap of some sort, you know, that wasn't there. So I really appreciate that that is there in the Dash 1 amendment. And quick question would be, was there a PUC order to restrict the size of the fund in March of 2016? Does that sound familiar?
Madam Chair, Representative Post, yes, you are correct. There was a proceeding at the commission, UM 1481. The end result of many years of that proceeding was a cap on the size of the fund, effectively, and that's why it's trending down to $21 million. The issue at hand is exactly what we're trying to get at here. Parties went to the commission and indicated that the law states clearly, and it does, this is true, that it's used to support voice only. To the extent that a network does many things, it provides voice, data, video, all those things. The thinking was, some parties thought, that the fund should only support that part of the network that provides voice service, and the other part of the network shouldn't get any support. Well, you can't really unbundle a piece of fiber and say this strand does this strand does that. It all does it, mm-hmm. all. What we finally agreed to was just a reduction in the fund size, $30 million to $21 million by the end of 2021. At 2019, we will reopen that proceeding and try to get a new stipulation in place by the end of 2021. So, yes, that's a long way of saying yes, I'm aware of that, and we agreed to that stipulation, sir. For the record here, I know there was a concern that on the part of some folks that we might try and go into that stipulation and reopen it and increase things and do other things. We will not do that at all. We signed that agreement, and we will live up to the language in that agreement all the way through to the bitter end.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for that question. Other questions? Yes, please. Brett Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. And more of a story. In my former life, I was a chamber president and director in our small community of Port Orford, and until 2009, Port Orford did not have high-speed internet access. We still had dial-up. We created a subcommittee through the chamber where a gentleman, the late Ed McQuaid, would call around to the various companies to see what we can do about high-speed internet. And by luck, he talked to somebody at Verizon who had stayed in Port Orford at one of our and visited our community. And she said, "What do you mean you don't have high-speed internet?" "Well, let me get back to you." And a couple hours later, Verizon was just installing high-speed in Port Orford, and it took two UPS trucks to bring all of the routers up for the 600-plus people that signed up within that week. And then we knew once that happened, then expansion would occur and other entities would come in and supply services, which is what has happened. Now, of course, Verizon and then Frontier and then Charter has expanded their service areas through the coast. You saw, and it was reported earlier, that we have quite a robust bandwidth, if that's the right term, mm-hmm. Along the coast. And there was significant investment by Charter to get the route redundancy that we worked on over some of the most desolate terrain through 199 and that area to for that route redundancy, which, as Representative Gomberg mentioned earlier, is critical to business infrastructure and just doing business. But more importantly, to attract new businesses to our areas, because we moving into the 21st century. So I feel the pain of Representative Reschke and how he is at the end of the loop over there, because that mm-hmm. was the case until less than a decade ago along the coast. And within that 9 years now, look at what we have. And so I appreciate this conversation, because there are so many folks that are in different areas that are in the same situation as we were 9 years ago. So that's my story.
That's nice. If you want to comment on that, you may.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Brocksmith, I appreciate that. And that really does get at what we're trying to do here. That's a good story. And, I guess I should say, I recognize that there are people who are opposed to this fund. Just generally speaking, they don't like this fund, and they don't like this bill. I get that. I just happen to disagree with them. And I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Rep. Clem, and then Rep. Boxman. Did you want to follow up, actually, first?
Yeah.
Or are you?
Go
ahead.
Thank you. And again, if you look at my situation as a model, the initial investment was made, but we're growing our communities and allowing that growth to expand the services into the companies that are paying into the fund, right? And then eventually those service expansions are benefiting everyone and everyone's and every the bottom line for the various industries that are providing the services now, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Rep. Clem.
So if we add broadband to the allowable use of the fund, how precisely does the mechanics work? The bill, I don't think it says, but how precisely is it? It goes to a county, because we're talking about a rural area, so which entity would the payments go to, and how would they, would they do an RFP and see who's going to meet the need if they're not a provider themselves, if they're just a unit of government or something?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Clem, the way the fund is set up now, the money flows to the carrier that provides the service to the community, and that would not change. What I envision happening would be if this bill passes and is signed into law, the association would file another petition with the commission to do exactly what we've asked them to do before. The support that goes to the carrier now for plain old telephone service would instead be able to be used to provide broadband service as well as plain old telephone service. So the recipients of the fund wouldn't change. It would be the carrier.
And what if there were multiple carriers?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, there are multiple carriers in certain areas, yeah, but only one carrier has the obligation to serve. So only that carrier would get the support. That's why you get the support, is because of the obligation, not because you want to serve it or you think you might. You have an obligation to serve because you're drawing from this public fund, and there's an obligation with that.
And And then I sit on the Broadband Advisor Council, but I don't make every meeting, or hardly any of them sometimes. Depends what's going on in my personal life. The federal programs, I remember Walden's got something, but what are some of the federal programs that are available?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, there is also a federal universal service fund that does pretty much the same thing. It's targeted to rural parts of the country. And in fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because that support is trending towards broadband support. Yeah. The FCC has already made some changes to allow for that kind of thing. And Congressman Walden has been active in those conversations as well, and helpful, actually, I should mention.
That's great. Yes, go ahead.
And then the last thing, it's set up right now, the funding mechanism is sort of based on hardline telephone lines.
Yes.
So then the question is, what about all the people who don't have one anymore, like me and everybody else who is under a certain age, apparently, who doesn't even realize they actually once existed either?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Clement, members of the committee, that is the bigger issue. I mean, as I've testified, the fund is getting smaller. It's not getting bigger. And with this bill, if it passes as amended, there's a cap on the surcharge, so that trend is only it's going to continue. Mm-hmm. So I think it's incumbent upon us, and we've talked about this, if the fund needs additional revenue, then it's up to people like me to come to you all and say other entities have to pay into it. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to get more revenue. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the right thing to do. I've said it before. We've tried that before, two times, and gotten nowhere fast. But I think the Universal Service Fund, it's underfunded and it's underutilized. I say that over and over and over again. And this bill doesn't change that situation, but maybe it's a first step towards changing the conversation anyway.
Thank you. That's helpful. Do you want to make any observation on that? Okay. All right. Thank you so much for being up here. I'm not going to ask you about the other bill, 2072, unless you want to speak about it.
That's
at
fine.
This point. Okay.
No,
thanks a lot.
I think Trey has some comments
okay,
on 2092.
Great. Yeah. All right. And then next up, let's please hear from, Mr. Conway. We heard from you before. You're welcome to come up, though, and speak specifically to the bill. You're second up on the list, so I'm going to call you up. And Samuel Pastrick, please, from Citizens Utility Board, and Chris Tamarin from OBDD. And then we'll have Mike Dewey come up in the next panel, and Trey Hicks. And then we will have heard from everyone who signed up. Thank you. You may go ahead in any order. That's right. So we have two people who we've heard from. Thank you. How about if we hear from Samuel Pastrick first, and then we would love to hear any remaining thoughts that you have on this.
Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh and Representative Brock Smith, committee members. My name is Samuel Pastrick, and I'm here with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Or rather, we just changed our name to Oregon Citizens Utility Board, so I should probably get that right. More often than not, you know, we're here to speak on energy issues, and that we represent customers of the investor-owned energy utilities in the state. However, we also have a very real stake with regard to telecommunications issues. I did have some very eloquent remarks prepared as regards 2091, but they more or less echo Brandt's. So I'll just take sort of a bullet point approach. So, and this has been mentioned, you know, broadband, by all accounts, and certainly in our opinion, is an essential utility service at this point. So therein lies our stake in this issue. You know, I think really this change proposed through 2091 to the Universal Service Fund is sort of core and very true to its mission, and that is to broaden access, especially to broaden access in rural areas of the state. You know, I'd also add that PUC, and I'll throw kudos in Brian's direction, they really do a good job of administering this fund. And, you know, I don't want to get too far into the weeds on whether or not it's underfunded or previous dockets, but they do a very good job, in our opinion, administering the fund. So I think that they are an appropriate entity to facilitate this change should it happen. Another remark that I'd like to make is that the legislature has, you know, routinely, especially in recent years, expressed interest in finding, you know, smart ways, good policy decisions to promote broadband expansion around the state. And I think, you know, this is a good example. And while, you know, 2091 certainly is not an absolute solution, I think it would represent a good step in the right direction, a smart policy decision. And I think it would reflect well on the legislature as well. Really, therein, I would strongly encourage you folks to vote yes and push this forward. I think it's good policy. Cub thinks it's good policy. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for that succinct and clear statement. All right, gentlemen, if you have additional thoughts that you'd like to have us consider as we're looking at 2091, please go ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Chair Leininger. Once again, Brian Conway from the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I wanted to do two things. First of all, let you know that our commission has not taken a position on this bill. and then, secondly, I heard some questions about, well, there's a federal fund and there's a state fund, and I thought it'd be worth clarifying that one of the things we do at the commission is we subtract off the federal funding so that we're not duplicating funding to something. So that we take that off first and then see is there money that's needed after that. And then, you know, finally, I think another thing that this provides an opportunity, as Brant talked about, networks serve many, many different purposes. And if you have a state subsidy that is, you know, aimed at a specific technology, you have the potential for encouraging, you know, inefficient investment. So that if you have a state fund or a state subsidy that's technologically neutral and doesn't care if you're putting in fiber or putting in copper, I think you get you know, some of the benefits of the market working as they can invest what they think makes most sense.
Thanks. That's really helpful. Oh, Representative Marsh.
Just a quick question. I understood Brant to say the fund was underutilized, and I'm not sure what he meant by that, but do you hand out all the money?
Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh, yes, we do. One of the things you heard from Brant was that the surcharge rate is capped, and as Representative Clem talked about, many people are cutting the cord. This is a surcharge on voice line services. So if you only collect 8.5% and the number of lines falls, the fund becomes smaller. So we do spend the money that's in it for these purposes, but it's shrinking. We're spending less and less as the fund size grows smaller.
Right. Thank you.
Maybe he's also noting that it could that some of the expenditures are not for the things that he sees as the highest need, but because of the limitation of where the expenditures can go currently, that it's less well utilized than it could be. I don't know. I guess you could speak to that later, Brant, if you want to. Thank you, though, for that question. Yes, sir.
Chair Leininger, I may have signed the wrong piece of paper. When I thought I was signing it as a speaker, I didn't mean to sign on as a testify for the bill.
You know what? I opened a public hearing on both of them at the same time. So, but we are focusing on OICs. You don't have testimony on this at all.
Yep.
Got it. All right. Well, welcome. Thank you again for your great remarks earlier. Any other questions for this group? Okay. Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate your input. And now we will invite Mike Dewey and Trey Hendricks forward. You're the last two speakers we have signed up, and would love to hear your thoughts about either 2091 or 2092, both of which are up for discussion in this hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. First of all, Representative Lewis, congratulations or condolences, not sure, but congratulations to your appointment. Thank you for allowing the OCTA to testify. I thought I'd first of all give you just a quick overview of the cable industry in that they are the, as a broadband companies, and I'll talk about the companies in a minute, as it they represent various districts here that sit at this dais. The cable companies are the largest residential broadband provider in terms of customers in the state of Oregon by a large margin, and the private sector is growing immensely. And rural Oregon is very important to the cable companies because we want that economy to scale, because we want to be able to provide vibrant broadband services and increased speeds to rural Oregon, which is extremely important. So just talking about some of our members, and you know who they are from your area, but Comcast is the largest provider, and they have a diverse line of business, primarily in the urban area from Portland to Eugene, and many counties in and around the urban area. Charter Communications, which recently bought Time Warner, which didn't affect Oregon because there were no Time Warner telecom cable system, broadband systems in Oregon, operates on the coast, Lincoln City all the way down to the southern coast. Eastern Oregon, for example, LeGrand, Burns, and other Klamath Falls have high-speed data. Representative, I'm sorry you're at the end of the Oregon Trail. We'll see if we can fix that in some way. You have Bend Broadband in Central Oregon, so it would be Sisters, Redmond, Bend, somewhat rural. Crestview Cable, small cable company, Legrand, excuse me, Madras, Lapine, Crooked River. Wave Broadband in Silverton, for example. So you have just the diversity of the state in rural Oregon. One thing I wanted to do is say that, for example, Comcast and Charter have a low-income program for those students that are on free lunch, so they get a break on their broadband service, and also for senior citizens, low-income. And that is just being rolled out by Charter Spectrum in the last few months based upon their agreement with the FTC and the FCC. So I just wanted to point out that we continue to make investments in rural Oregon. One thing you need to be cognizant of, though, is, and this is going to be very important, for example, Eugene has a 7% fee tax, however you want to look at it, on broadband access. It would affect Comcast. So that immediately increases the cost of broadband service in Eugene by 7% if you're a Comcast customer. Other cities, local governments are looking at that. And as you want adoption, if the price goes up because it's passed on, it's something that we're talking about internally. There's no legislation that deals with this. But I just want to point out that fees and taxes can be an impediment to adoption of broadband. And there is the trade-off between city services, which I get, and use of the right-of-way, and then what is the appropriate tax, because you're taxing the video service, the telephone service, and the broadband service over the same pipe. So I just wanted to point that out, that that could be an impediment to adoption as we go forward. So with regard to 2091, what I wanted to say is we appreciate, and Brant's testimony was excellent, that OTA has put the cap at 8.5%. We were involved in the stipulation at the PUC. Trey was involved in that, and I'm glad we're not doing that right now. It looks like in 2019 we will start again. But the 8.5% cap is important in the sense that you have a situation where at some point you're going to have to address that. Now is not the time, in our opinion, to have that discussion, but it is one of the highest in the United States. And it can only go up if you're trying to raise money. It can't go down. So we appreciate that. The emergency clause, we appreciate that. We want to say that it's very important for the Oregon economy that we have a vibrant broadband system. And we're going to be a part of that. I can't predict where all that's going to go. We talked about 5G, being able to get applications in and get the infrastructure in place is going to take time. Some of the actual infrastructure is pretty big, and so you will have pole attachment issues as you go forward. That's not for you. That's for the owners of the poles, the PUC, terms and conditions, but it's not going to happen overnight. But as you move forward, we think you need to take a look and inventory. What are the unserved areas of the state of Oregon? And that's where you want to go first. And you want to be sure, because there's probably only one provider that could provide that service. And there's probably a subsidy. And so that is first where you should go in terms of broadband infrastructure investments. Because there's going to be a subsidy, I think, just because of the density. And you might want to have an RFP. I don't know. We haven't thought this out. This bill isn't really complicated, because where the complication occurs is we are going to change the formula by which we appropriate the money. And historically, my clients haven't received any of the money. That's fine. We just want to be sure that at the end of the day, it goes to the right place. The formula works, and that's going to be at the PUC, and there is a strong audit potential, so the money is spent where it needs to be spent, in rural Oregon as opposed to urban Oregon, where there's substantial competition. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stop if you have any questions, but you may want Trey to speak.
Okay. I actually would love to ask you a question first, and if others have questions, I think it'd be okay to bisect the presentations. Sure. And have people ask questions. So I feel like what I just heard you say was you want to make sure that it's spent in areas that need it, and not just available to all areas, perhaps where it's not as needed. Did you say that you feel like if we gave clear legislative intent direction to PUC, that suffices, or are you hoping to provide an amendment? I want to kind of understand, or do you feel fine about the bill as it's currently drafted, but you want to have the record reflect that the intent is to utilize the funding in underserved rural areas, not perhaps rural areas that have lots of redundancy and plenty of capacity?
Yeah, Madam Chair, so I think there are a few questions in there. So let me see if I can get them right. So first of all, so if this bill were to pass in its present form, the benchmark language makes sense to take that out because nobody knows what that means. So what we anticipate, and I think Brant also anticipated, that we would have a proceeding at the PUC because, as Representative Clem mentioned, this is a telephone-centric system based on, in some part, wire centers and what is the cost of running a wire center. Well, now we have a different set of circumstances. We're talking about a network. What does it cost to run most efficiently the network? So you have a pot of money, and you're going to have a formula, and we'll be involved in that. I'm sure CenturyLink will. So it doesn't stop with the legislation that you pass, and somehow the money just gets appropriated. In my mind, and I think others, there's going to have to be a discussion about how do you appropriate the money that exists in the pot today in an efficient manner, and who needs it the most. So that's what I'm trying to say. With regard to the legislation, you know, at some point, I think, and we haven't done this yet, in my mind, we haven't looked at, okay, where are the areas that are unserved? Where do we need to put the money most? We've got a system that is kind of historic, 1999 or whatever, and it's a good opportunity just to look at it and say, okay, why isn't that there's not an investment in this in Sherman County? And how do we get that investment? And our thinking is it might have to be an RFP or something and allow the companies to participate in that with the recognition there might be a subsidy. And only one company at the end of the day that's going to come there because that's how the business model will work.
May I jump in? But that's all at a PUC level,
legislative exactly.
level. Great. Okay.
Exactly.
Thanks.
So hopefully that
yeah,
answers
it does.
Your question.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
But I want to be very clear that we are in rural Oregon. We're committed to providing service in rural Oregon. And we just want to make sure, as you know, this is kind of taxpayer money. We want to make sure it's spent the most efficient way. And at the end of the day, there's transparency. That's all we're saying.
Yeah.
And hopefully we're involved in that discussion in terms of providing those services where they need to be served.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate that. Trey, Mr. Hendricks.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs Brock Smith and Marsh, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. First of all, just to introduce myself, my name is Trey Hendricks. I am new to this job. You may remember Barbara Young. She's retiring, and I am going to be, as best I can, filling in for her going forward. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity to continue to work with you all. I don't envy you in this particular job. As Brant mentioned, this is a very, very complex industry, and the issues are complex. I've been doing it as a technician and then as a staffer up at the Washington Commission and an ALJ up there. Last 16 years working for Sprint and then Embark and now CenturyLink in mostly legal roles. And I'm still learning on a daily basis. So it's a journey, and it's not always an easy one. I'm primarily going to talk to you about House Bill 2092. We do support House Bill 2091, and I need to say that. House Bill 2092 involves carrier of last resort obligations. And essentially what it does is it says that a company in an area that does not receive state universal service funding funds would not be required to provide service. Not to say that a company wouldn't. It's a business, and that's how we make money. The reason that's important is that these are areas where there generally is competition. And as Mr. Cameron spoke earlier, and as Mike just pointed out, cable companies are the dominant provider of telephone service and broadband service now in the state. Used to be back in the 80s and 90s before competition was mandated by the federal government, used to be that CenturyLink, and I'm mostly talking about Quest and formerly US West now, it used to be we were a monopoly. We had 100% of the market share. There was no Comcast, at least not in the form it is today. They might have provided cable TV service, but they certainly didn't provide any broadband or telephone service. That has fundamentally changed everywhere in CenturyLink's footprint. The company in Oregon, in most places, serves less than 30% of the people who are buying telecommunications service. And that is just a remarkable reversal in the marketplace. And yet, even though we only serve 30%, the company continues to have this obligation to provide service. When the company was a monopoly, what it did was, and the commission regulated this, is it charged prices in very low-cost areas that were much higher than the cost to provide service. Took that money, it's an implicit subsidy, and it used it to fund the services that it provided in the very high cost areas. So you'd pay $50 in Portland or something like that, it cost $25 to serve. The company accumulated essentially all that money, took it and used it to serve customers where it cost $700 a month to serve. So because the company only serves 30% of the market, A, and B, it only can charge a price in those markets that is competitive, much lower price, that implicit subsidy is gone. So we've done things like the Universal Service Fund. There's federal funding now to try and address that. But it's not addressing it, and still, in these areas where the company is serving very few of the customers, it has the obligation, while its competitors don't. So it's at a competitive disadvantage. And as Mr. Tamron said earlier, where there's competition, services are better and they're lower priced. The market works. And what House Bill 2092 does is it recognizes that fact. It says in an area where the company is not receiving universal service support, it shouldn't have those same obligations as its competitors. It's rational, it makes business sense, and it's better for customers in Oregon in the long run. And really, I mean, we see it as just a good first step to recognizing the competitive environment. So, I have more to say, but as I said, it's a complex issue, and I think that really captures why this is so important to CenturyLink and companies like CenturyLink. And just to kind of give you a flavor, CenturyLink serves 81 exchanges in the state of Oregon. We divide up our service areas by exchange. We have, maybe a half a dozen in Portland, and then in areas like Ashland and some of the smaller areas, that's just one exchange. We only receive support in 37 of those exchanges. So CenturyLink is really primarily 44 exchanges, a rural telecommunications company. So it's a big obligation. We'd ask that the committee seriously consider moving this bill along. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Great. Rep. Marsh.
Yes, just to clarify, all of a sudden, as you speak, the magnitude of what you're asking sort of dawning on me. The areas in which you don't receive universal fund include urban areas, as you just described.
Yes,
Portland,
largely.
Ashland, other places.
Correct.
So you would no longer have an obligation to be the landline provider in those areas?
Yeah, just for plain old telephone service. Correct.
So there, follow up.
Please, yes.
So there would be no mandated landline provider in our urban core or the non-subsidized areas of your service area, of anyone's service area?
Chair Leininger, Vice Chair Marsh, there would be no obligation imposed upon the company and or any others. That's true. There would, however, still obviously be a business interest to do so.
So I think you're highlighting a great point. I'm going to go to Rep. Reschke in just a second. But I think what I'm hearing is, you know, in the areas where it's not does it make financial sense to be the landline service provider, what this suite of bills says is either enable us to utilize universal service fund dollars to get done the things we need to do to be able to deliver the service not at a loss, which is House Bill 2091, or release us from the obligation to deliver service there because we can't. We're not a regulated monopoly that can cross-subsidize. And if you force us to be the service provider of last resort in certain areas where it's not profitable, but we have no universal service fund dollars, you're forcing us to operate at a loss. And so sort of the issue is pick one, but don't leave it as status quo. Or at least that's what I think I'm hearing. If I've got it wrong, jump in. But then I'm going to go to Rep. Reschke. I think that's a reasonable point.
Yeah, Chair Leininger, I think for most companies that's true. CenturyLink is a little different. Most of the other telecommunications providers, the incumbent ones, like the other OTA members, receive support throughout their territory. Okay, there are no unsupported exchanges. And in fact, a couple of CenturyLink subsidiaries, United Telephone Company, the old CenturyTel, companies are rural telecommunications companies, and those companies receive support throughout their area. Quest, which is the largest subsidiary, formerly U.S. West, of CenturyLink, as I mentioned earlier, there are areas where it doesn't receive any USF support, and yet it still has the obligation to serve in those areas, even though it's no longer funded to do so.
It's interesting. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for coming. Can you walk me through how the fund is, what's the mechanism for receiving the fund? Does CenturyLink ask for it in a particular exchange, or is the fund just come to you and therefore the obligation is put on you? And where I'm going with this is what I don't want to see happen is in a rural area, you say, we don't want the fund money anymore. Also, we're now no longer obligated to serve this area, and now we have no landline provider or voice provider in that area.
So, Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Is Reschke?
I've heard it all, so you know, I'm sure I'll hear more. Reschke works good. Go with that.
I'll have to go with Reschke. So, you know, there's a long history in this fund, and for Quest, the exchanges in which it receives funding were established by the commission many years ago, 2000-2001 timeframe, and you know, CenturyLink has never asked or petitioned, I don't believe, to not receive funding in any of the areas where it does. That would result in, I would presume, a reduction in the amount of funding the company receives. And as far as I know, it has no plans to do so. So I don't see that as a risk.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, just quickly. The incumbents, in terms of how the money flows, and the rural carriers, there are two different ways that two different methodologies by which they work.
Okay.
And I'm probably not wise to go any further than that because you have a formula that is, the economists started this, you know, in 2000, and the discussion was, you know, in 2001, too, how to best do this. Things have changed, and that's why we're having this conversation today.
Okay. Thank you. That's great. All right. So we are just about at the end of our session. I'm not going to work the bill today, but I do plan to have us have a work session on House Bill 2091. I think we will hold that over to a meeting perhaps next week. And for now, this was good input. I think there are some good conversations about steps for the implementation of the work. And we'll close the informational hearing for now with the expectation that we'll work the bill later. And if there's no more business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned. Thanks. This meeting is adjourned. Thanks.